originating from our Jimmy John's of Lexington studios. This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Sabre wins the Derby for Todd Fletcher.
Basalt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And Dialed In never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Now here's Jude Feld.
Good evening, everyone, wherever you may be. Trainer Talk is on the air. As usual, tonight's broadcast, sponsored by Fasig Tipton, is the show that trainers listen to. This is Jude Feld, and I'm absolutely delighted to spend the next hour with you and our special guest. Tonight's trainer is a Paris, Kentucky native. As this show airs, he has won 1,733 races with 1,721 seconds, 1,536 thirds, while amassing $65,054,596 in purses. He is the third leading trainer of all time at Keeneland, behind Hall of Famers D-Wayne Lucas and Bill Mott, and he has been the leading trainer at Keeneland three times. Most impressively, to me at least, he's been among the top 100 trainers in North America by purse earnings every year since the turn of the century. Welcome to Trainer Talk, Rusty Arnold.
Thank you, Jude.
So how'd you do it?
Well, I've been very fortunate to hook up with some very, very good people, and where a lot of people had, I think, owners go in and out of the business or move on, and I've had a string of long associations with different people, and it's kind of kept me going, and probably just longevity more than anything else. I think this is my 43rd year.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I read you started in 1975, and that's a long time to be a trainer. It's a lot of getting up every morning for years on end, but the results are there.
Yeah, it's you've done it a long time. You don't think about the getting up. I think any trainer would tell you that. That's just part of what you do, and probably that'll be something you miss when you don't do it anymore. But dealing with the horses, something I think almost every trainer or every one of them enjoy, so it makes the getting up not a problem.
Yes, it's a great life because you can't wait to get to work. Most of your friends are dreading it. You know, the people have that blue feeling on Sunday night. They have to go to work on Monday morning. Trainers are really not like that. And I got news for you. I retired in 2001, and I still get up at 4:30 every morning. It's the best time of the day for me.
Yeah, I think when you get a little time off, which isn't a lot, you still get up at the same time. But you tend to get up and walk a little more brisk when you have a better group of horses in your barn. It makes you get there a little quicker.
Yeah, that's for sure. One of the fun things about preparing for Trainer Talk is learning cool things about trainers that I didn't know. And that stat, the top 100 out of thousands of trainers all over the country for the last 18 years, that's unbelievably cool. Did you know that?
Actually, I did not know that. That was a stat you gave me I didn't know. And I've just been very fortunate to get handed a lot of nice horses. And things have worked out well for me. I haven't made it to, the very top. I haven't won a classic. I've won quite a few graded races. But I'd like to win one before it's over. I'd like to win a Breeders' Cup race, which I have not done. But I guess I'd describe it as a journeyman's career. So that's what I feel like.
Well, it's really pretty special. I think you have 9 Grade 1 wins by my count, at least as far back as I could find. But
yeah, I think you're light on that.
Am I?
Yeah. I think there's somewhere around 16 or 17 of them.
Oh, is there? Wow, that's cool.
Yeah, but that's all right.
The stats only go back so far. But you're a third generation trainer. Your grandfather James Russell worked for Historic Elmendorf Farm. Tell us about him a little bit.
My grandfather's what probably is responsible for putting our whole family into the horse business. He came out of Lee County, Kentucky, and got a job working on the horse farms. Probably didn't know anything about horses when he did that, and that would have been in the very early 1900s. And he got our family in the horse business, and my father moved on into the horse business and ended up working for several people and then having his own farm until he passed away 2 years ago. And my brother, until this year, I guess, managed Dixiana Farm and then opened up his own operation. And we're all to the, result of our grandfather putting us in the horse business, way back, well over 100 years ago.
Yeah, that's really cool. Well, Elmendorf had such a great history of success for many, many years. And I always said if I ever hit Lotto, that's the first thing I do is go buy Elmendorf Farm. I used to love betting on those horses when I was a kid.
Yeah, I remember, spending a little time there when I was really young when we'd visit my grandfather. I was very close to him. But one of my special moments is when I won the Widener, and the Widener, Pete Widener, who was the grandson of George Widener, gave the trophy away and to us that day. And that was a great feeling that my grandfather kind of started in the horse business with the Widener family with his grandfather, and I got to be handed the trophy by Pete Widener when the Widener shot. That one hangs on the wall. Not many hang on the wall, but that one does.
That's really cool. That was one of the grade ones I don't have on this list.
It wasn't a grade one. It was a grade one. It was West by West, but it was probably the Widener had dropped to a grade two, but it was one of my favorites.
Yeah. Well, you did win the Nassau County Handicap with West by West, too. He was a cool horse, huh?
He was. He was probably the best horse I had for Mr. Peace, who was I trained for somewhere around 15 years, and a great, great gentleman out of New York, and he was one of the better horses we had, and one of the first, I guess it could have been the first crop of Gone West. He was one of them, if not the first crop, and I had a in the Nassau was a great race. I think Strike the Cold was in there, had a Derby winner, Devil Is Due of Jerkins, and those were great handicap horses, and he was fit right amongst the best of them at that period.
Yeah, and he went on to be a successful sire and a very good broodmare sire.
He's got a better broodmare sire than a sire, probably.
Yeah. Well, your father, George Arnold Sr., was a successful trainer, and were you a barn rat growing up? Did you hang out at the track most of the time?
Not at all, actually. I stayed on the farm through high school because he had his farm operation, and I liked the farm quite a bit. And didn't get off of it. And then I guess when I was probably started into college, I could come to the Keeneland in the morning and work and put myself through school, and the hours worked better than the farm. I could come out to Keeneland and be here in the morning and then go right on into UK and have a full schedule, and got more interested in it at that time because all my early years were on the farm. And then when I started working the racetracks in the morning, I got really interested in it and did that probably only went to UK 2.5 years and got very interested, and then decided to take that semester off. If you've ever gone to college, and when you take that semester off, you say, I'm going to take one semester off. And I went to Florida for the winter and got a job galloping horses and never went back, as a lot of people do. I don't suggest that to anybody. When you take that semester off, you usually take the rest of your career off of school. So I got a job in Florida and went to work on the racetrack and stayed. I think that was probably in 1974 or 1975.
Yeah. So as you were going through all of this, who else did you work for when you were honing your skills and learning to be a trainer?
I actually worked for my dad and a gentleman at Keystone at the time, I'll call it, named Gene Euster. And those were the only two jobs I had. And he had My Juliet. People don't remember him because he was a Pennsylvania person, but he had a champion, and he had her before I was there. I did not work with her, but he had a big operation at Keystone at the time, and I spent probably when I left my dad, I spent time working with him, and then came back to Kentucky, and when I left him and hung up my shingle and started at River Downs is where I started, and then got into the Kentucky circuit after a couple of years.
In case you're joining us late, this is Jude Feld, and you're listening to Trainer Talk with Rusty Arnold. River Downs, that was kind of a cool place to race back in the day. It started a lot of people, and a lot of trainers won their first stakes races and stuff there. Talk about River Downs a little bit, and now that it's actually gone, it's called Belterra Park now, but River Downs had its own personality.
It was really a neat place. When I first started going there, Coney Island was still there. And it was, you know, just basically, you almost thought it was part of the amusement park. It laid right on the river. And it was. It was a unique place to race. Had the old grandstand, the barns, and they had everything but a lot of money. And it was a fun place to go and a fun place to get started. And there were a lot of people that got started there. I think the second year I was there and my last year that I was there, Steve Coffins was the leading rider there. And it started several. And then, of course, the story continues with Perry Utes, who was, I think, the second leading rider to Steve Coffins when I started my career, and now he's, just won his 8,000th race, or so, I think 8,000, and I think he's an amazing story that he's still riding at the level he is and just keeps winning.
Yeah, he's a really cool guy. I started working for the racing form there in 1978. That was my first real job on the racetrack, and it was really cool. My life, I trained for Mr. Hoover that owned the racetrack, and he was a wonderful man and a great guy to train for. And I always told him I wanted to be left the stock in River Downs, but he didn't put me in his will. I was very disappointed.
Well, that's when I was there, that's how I ended up hooking up with a great job, which was one of the people that got me started when I was young, was Dr. Taylor Asbury of Forest Retreat Farm. And they were Cincinnati people, but their farm was in, I think, over the river into Maysville, Kentucky. And they had a beautiful farm there. And they raced a lot around there. And I met him and worked for him for quite a few years. And they ended up staying in a horse called Nascra. And they were the toughest, nicest bunch of horses you can have, and they raised just a really tough horse and really had a lot of nice horses for Dr. Asbury, and kind of got me going, he and two or three other people around Lexington.
Well, it's just so interesting to find out, you know, where people start and how they get their clients and all that. It's an amazing life, and you're such a Kentucky guy. I mean, born in Kentucky, went to UK, all Keeneland's such a huge part of your life. When I moved from California to Kentucky to go to work for Keeneland in 2001, I knew who you were. Little Missouri was one of my favorite horses, and Jim Williams, director of communications at Keeneland, told me right away about your streak there and how important it was that I stay on top of it. Tell us about that incredible Keeneland streak.
Yeah, we had a great run, and of course it ended 3 or 4 years ago, but we had won a race at Keeneland at every meet. I think it was 66 or 67 meets, which was 33 or 34 years, and it was quite interesting because it kind of caught on, and people were always wanting to keep it going, and I think about 3 years ago we got shut out, which, you know, at Keeneland they call it getting the duck, they might call it everywhere, and we ran into a string of seconds and did not win one and had to start a new streak, and it's about 4 or 5 years old, but I don't think it'll reach the level of the other one. I don't think I'll make it that long.
Yeah, that's a lot of meets left, but it was fantastic. I mean, it was so kind of nerve-wracking until you won a race, you know. I used to just like go, when's he going to win? When's he going to win? And the year you didn't win, it was so disappointing. I felt so badly for you. But for you, when it was over, were you sad or were you relieved?
No, I was probably a little sad. You know, I would have liked for it to have gone on. Probably one of the most exciting times of that was when we won with our last starter in the meet on the last day. And that kept it going, and it went another couple of years after that. I still remember the horse. It was a two other than, I think it was Exothermic. And Corey Lannery rode him, and I said, I told him in a paddock, I said, this is it for me. It's the last runner I've got. It was the last day, and he came flying down the middle of the turf course and got up and won, and Kurt Becker made an announcement about it, and it was kind of pretty neat for just a average day allowance race, and meant a lot to us. And I wasn't devastated when it ended at all, because it had been a great run, and didn't shake me up, but I would have probably preferred it to keep going.
That's one of those records, though, that, I mean, it's probably never going to be beaten, right? Especially in today's day and age when trainers travel around and have horses at different tracks and stuff. I mean, I don't think anybody could do that. Do you?
Yeah, it's just one thing is because it was so long, and you said people move on and they change jobs and might not even race one here. So I think it'll stand, I believe, for a while. I think so.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. You had another streak with a horse named Divine Warning who won at least one race at five consecutive Keeneland meets. Wayne Lucas would say that's a tribute to your program. How difficult was it to keep Divine Warning happy and fit and in good form?
He was a neat horse. Bill Ryan owned him out of he was actually from Cincinnati, Jim Ryan's brother, and that was a horse that just loved the Keeneland turf course. It was very on, if not the first I could be wrong, but it was either the first year or the second year that started when they built the turf course. And it was very on in it. It was a sandy-type turf course, and he just loved it. And he would get to Florida. We'd try to get one race in him. He never would win in Florida. I don't think he ever did. He'd come to Keeneland, and he'd win. And I don't think he won two in a meet here, but several times he ran twice and either had a second, a third, and a win or a win. But he might have won twice at a meet, because I think he ended up winning seven races at Keeneland over a five meet period. So he obviously did, but he was a really, really neat horse to have.
Yeah, sometimes, you know, in today's day and age, horses really only have meets. They don't really have careers. And one of the nice things about your stable is your horses seem to last a long time, and they're competitive at a high level. What's that key? How do you keep that going?
I think, dude, a lot of it's the people you work for and what they want to do. I think one of the proudest things our barn has is when we won Grade One with Carillion and you can correct me if I'm wrong, at eight, and it was his first Grade One as an 8 year old. And because when he'd have a problem, Mr. Masson would say, send him home. They would send him home, and they'd give him the time that he needed, and then they would send him back to you. And, you know, Watts Humphrey to several people. I'm probably going to miss out on somebody. I've been very, very fortunate to have people that would give the horses the time they needed instead of like, oh, push on and put them in for $75,000. It was always send them home. We'll take care of them. We'll send them back, and it extends horses' careers. And I think it's few trainers have the luxury of having people to do that. And it's not as commonplace as it used to be.
Yeah. Do you have to educate your new clients now into the Rusty Arnold way of doing things, or do they come to you because they understand that you're patient and you take your time with horses?
I think they understand the program. I don't have a whole lot of new younger people. I've had an extremely strong Kentucky base of people for a long time, and they're still with me. And there's a few, but I think they know when you come in that you're not going to have a really, really exciting 2 year old early in the year, but you probably might have him at in the fall, and you have a good chance to have him around for a while. And I think that works for some people, and others it doesn't. And hopefully, and not that mine's the right program and somebody else is wrong. It just, you have to match the owner and what his expectations or his goals are with what you do. And there could be owners that are great owners that might not have the same ideals, and they go on and do fabulous. But when you match up with the same goals, it works really well.
Yeah, that's something that I always tell people that are looking for trainers. You know, I say it should be like your looking for a girlfriend or whatever, you got to go, you know, talk to the trainers, see what they're about, see if you have the same goals and aspirations and how you want to go about things, because there's a different trainer for everybody. I mean, some people like a lot of action and they may need a guy that runs the horses back quick or is a claiming trainer, whatever. And then other people have more patience and can do it, you know, taking their time and trying to develop a horse into, you know, a stallion or a top broodmare or something like that. So there's a trainer out there for you, but you just have to find the person that suits you.
I agree 100%. I mean, there are a lot of really, really good owners, and some of them are friends of mine that probably like something a little different than I do. And there are a lot of trainers that are good friends that do things a little bit different. And you've just got to find the person that suits and get with that person, and you'll have a long-time relationship that way, and it'll work for you.
Well, let's step back in time a little bit. One of the reasons I really wanted to have you on tonight, in light of Justify's tremendous victory in the Kentucky Derby and his breaking of the Apollo curse, was to talk about Glencrest Farms' Wavering Monarch. His winning debut came on April 2nd, and he ran in the Kentucky Derby on May 1st. Now, by my calculations, that's a month. tell us that story.
Well, and probably the part of it you're leaving out, it was his fourth start when he ran in the Kentucky Derby in a month, too. But times were a bit different then. I was extremely young, 28 years old. I hadn't been training that long, and we knew we had a really good horse. I actually came with him and Runaway Groom at the same time. I was spending my winters in New York. I didn't have the stock or the people to go to Florida, so I was in New York, and I was working Runaway Groom and Wavering Monarch together. And we knew we had something, even though I was young and hadn't had anything. I think I'd had one graded stakes winner at the time, The Wheel Turns, for Glencrest Farm. And this horse was just doing everything right. I had actually called Randy Romero's agent about a month before we came back to Kentucky, and I said, I've got the horse for you, and we're going to be ready, and he'll be ready when we get there. And he was going to run in New York before I came, and we had a little setback and small injury, wasn't bad, and set him back a little bit, so we didn't get to the races to Keeneland. He won really easy, which used to be done. Run him back quick. We ran back in somewhere around 10 days, and he won easier. And we decided to run into Bluegrass. And we ran him into Bluegrass. It was his third start in probably 20 days, which now is unheard of, especially after you're sitting here telling everybody how patient I was, and then you tell this story. And he ran great in the Bluegrass. I think he led to about the eighth pole. He finished third to Linkage and Gato del Sol, beat him right on the wire for second. And we had no intentions of running in the Derby. We had just backed off of him a little bit for, you know, the next two or three days. And I hope my memory's right. Somebody, one of the favorites, got either colic. Would it have been Timely Rider, maybe? Would that be 82? There was a couple of horses that just all at once were done. And I'm like, oh, we got a Derby horse. I didn't know. I just probably wasn't ready for a horse of that ability at the time, and we threw him in the Derby, and he finished 10th, 12th, right in the middle of the pack, and everybody's head came together after that and said, wait a minute, we've got something really special here. Let's back up and do this the right way. And for the rest of his career, he was handled probably properly, where that month he wasn't handled properly. I think David Greathouse and I were both young, and he just fell in our lap, and all at once here it was, and we didn't handle him really the right way. And after that, I think we gave him plenty of time. He won the Jefferson Cup, then he won in Omaha, and then he won the Haskell. And he was sold, and I didn't have him after that, but it turned out to be, he was my first grade one winner, and the story ended up well. But I think that was just, we got excited when we were young. We hadn't had anything of that ability, and we did way too much with it.
Well, Well, I didn't blame you for the impatience. I blamed David Greathouse for it.
I think you blame us both. We were feeding off each other and the press clippings at the time.
Yeah, I can see that because even though you're a laid back guy, David he used to get pumped up pretty easy. So and he always looked for the biggest race he could run in. He never met a grade one he didn't like. So
no, he wasn't scared of a challenge.
Yeah, he's a cool guy. So, I mean, that's amazing. April 2nd, April 14th, 12 days, April 22nd, back in 8th for the Bluegrass, finished 3rd, May 1st, the Derby. And then you gave the horse some time. He didn't run again till June 12th.
Right.
Yeah, well, so it was June 12th.
That seemed like a long time for him.
Yeah. The June 12th, the Jefferson, July 3rd, the Omaha Gold Cup, and that was a grade two. And then the at Axarbon. And then on the 31st of July, the Haskell. I mean, that's just an amazing, amazing few months. I mean, to start in April and win the Haskell at the end of July, just fabulous. I mean, it's amazing when you think about it. Why do horses only run six times a year now?
I'm going to quote somebody and without getting his whole quote in there, but I'll remember Seth Hancock saying something that I'm a big believer in, and one of our downfalls was when we started breeding horses to sell instead of to race. And I think we started breeding stamina out of horses to make them prettier and faster looking because they sold better. And I'm not going to duck it. I know the trainers get blamed for everything right now. It's our fault that the handle's down. It's our fault the sales are down. That medication's our fault. But I do believe in breeding. When it changed X number of years ago, 20, 30, 40 years ago, and they wanted to breed a pretty fast-looking horse that would sell well, and the horses that stayed around for 7 or 8 years were kind of, that's not a big deal anymore. I mean, even the stallions that go home now have to be early, and they have to be fast, and they've got to be attractive, and the horses that come along and win the Jockey Club Gold Cup, which used to be 2 miles, and it was a mile and a half, and now it's probably a mile and eight, those horses are a forgotten thing. And I believe that has a whole lot to do with it.
Yeah, that's an interesting take on it. You're listening to Trainer Talk. This is Jude Feld. I'm with Rusty Arnold. We're having a great time. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and we'll be back after these words.
Selected sales, superior results. Nominate now to Fasig Tipton's selected yearling sales, which are stronger than ever. The July sale for precocious athletic yearlings, the prestigious Saratoga sale, where leading buyers have searched for their next champion or classic winner for nearly 100 years, and the New York bred sale, which offers the cream of the New York bred crop. Learn more and nominate at FasigNoms.com. Fasig Tipton selected yearling sales, stronger than ever.
Bloom Racing.
Sky Diamonds takes the lead. Sky Diamonds to win going away.
Started by former jockey and 35-year racing industry veteran Jeffrey Bloom, Bloom Racing offers racing partnerships, bloodstock services, pinhooking, and private race management.
Midnight Bizou with another assertive final furlong. The top filly of the meet deservedly wins the Grade 1 Santa Anita Oaks.
Experience the fun, excitement, and exclusive access of racehorse ownership with Bloom Racing. Forming racing partnerships now. Get in on the action at BloomRacing.com.
Exaggerator, Carlin's all-time leading son, is still the last three-year-old colt to win 3 grade ones in a single season, with extreme wins in the Santa Anita Derby, Preakness, and Haskell.
Exaggerator, an absolutely brilliant victory in the Santa Anita Derby.
A tremendous performance from Exaggerator.
But Exaggerator has turned the tables. He has won the Preakness Stakes.
His extreme foals are arriving now.
A leader in turf racing across North America, Woodbine, one of the world's most dynamic gaming, racing, and entertainment companies, returns for championship thoroughbred horse racing in April. Committed to racing excellence and innovation, Woodbine is proud to offer the Graded Stakes Bonus Program for the 2018 racing season, allowing horsemen and women alike more opportunities to race against the best of the best. Woodbine continually strives to bring the most competitive and high-quality fields to the horse racing community and to its fans. And with this offer, now is your chance to race with champions. Owners, trainers, and horses come for the action and excitement. They come for the finest in hospitality treatment and dining. They come for the competitive purses. They come to Woodbine, the Northern Gem, transcending the sport of racing today for tomorrow. To learn more about the Graded Stakes Competition Bonus, call the Woodbine Race Office today.
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
New York Central turns for home in front. Funny Duck is set to strike in tight. Well, in behind, giving Minute Cut the corner. Lombo is there too. Shane Zane on the far outside. Sporting Chance down the center of the track. There's one furlong to go. Here's Funny Duck on the outside. New York Central has to fight back, and these two are shoulder to shoulder. Funny Duck grabs the lead. Funny Duck opening up by two now. New York Central back into second. Give Me a Minute late in the scene for third. But in the slop, it's Funny Duck by three. New York Central was second, Give Me a Minute was third, and Sporting Chance was fourth.
Welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. This is Jude Feld with our special guest, trainer Rusty Arnold. I want to remind you that if you missed any portion of this show, it will be archived on our website, horseracingradio.net, and is also available at Horse Racing Radio on iTunes. Rusty, one of the other reasons I wanted to have you on this week was to talk about the race we just heard, arguably the most influential race of Oaks and Derby weekend, especially for horse players. The Pat Day Mile that you won with Funny Duck, amazing. A lot of tickets went up in smoke there. What gave you the confidence to run him in this spot?
Well, I'm gonna give all the credit to Mr. Kelly. We were going to run him in the grass race. The horse had trained really well. I ran this horse once on the dirt, first time out. He didn't pick his feet up. He just didn't run at all and did a little pedigree research. He had a lot of grass pedigree in the dam. And we just said, let's try him on the grass. Well, he ran pretty well. The race might not have shown it, but there was some trouble in the race. He finished on. He galloped out good. Then he went on and was second. Then he went on and won. And we said, I've got a little future, and the horse is all right. And about 2 weeks before we had him nominated to both races, and Mr. Kelly had said, let's try him on a dirt one more time. He relayed that to Eddie Kane, who said, we'd like to try him on a dirt one more time. And I said, let's try him on a dirt one more time then. And we put a really nice work in him. Brian Hernandez worked him one morning, and he said, you know, this horse went really well. He said he finished up good. He galloped up good. I liked the way he went. And we were in the race. Obviously, he had the one bad dirt race, and he was a big price, but he had come into it really well. Then we got the slop. Dude, he might have loved the slop. That we can't answer because it was the first time in it, but I know I was watching him down the backside. He didn't get away good. He took a stumble at the gate, and with my wife, Sarah, we're watching him at 5-8 pole. I said, oh, this horse is running, and he's getting a good trip. At the half-mile pole, I told her, I said, we're going to be near the lead when they turn for home. I mean, he's passing the horse now every time he hits the wire, and it's just going to be for him to finish it off. And then he was just full of run down the lane. So, I know it ended. I had people call me and tell me that it ended their ticket. And, of course, the lady in Rotama that got it, she was very happy with me. So they picked up the $1.2 million on her $18.
Yeah. She should have an autographed photo of you somewhere in her house.
Yeah, but when you read the people that talked about leaving him off their ticket and that, and it probably had a it was a big deal on Derby Day, I'll have to say. And to win that race 2 years in a row was kind of nice, too.
Yeah.
And a slop both years.
Yeah, we've had a string of bad racetracks for the Derby lately. But, you know, it was amazing to me. I went home on the private bus that Town & Country had for their guests at the Derby, and more people were talking about Funny Duck than we're talking about Justify, and I thought, wow, that's really amazing. You know, because Justify was impressive and a lot of hype and stuff, and your horse had no hype, but he's probably the horse they're going to remember most. Plus, he's got a cool name. So.
Yeah, that was the play. One of the reasons you could play him, I guess, was because of his name that day. The people that did play him, I think that's why, not because of his form.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he was fantastic, and it was really cool. Brian had the biggest smile on his face when he crossed the wire.
He did.
I was watching the big screen. Yeah. He looked like he knew something nobody else knew. It must have been that workout. Put him high on the list.
Yeah, he had been on him, so he might have liked him more than we did. But he loved the way he worked that day. And that day he said, I want to ride him. So it was a great day.
Yeah, he's a really good rider, huh? I've liked him since he was a bug boy.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a bad one to ask because we have such a great relationship, and he gets on so many of our, better horses, and I have just a lot of confidence in him. And he'll tell you when he did something wrong, and he's turned into a really good horseman on top of being a good rider. He tells us what he thinks about a horse, what he might be, what might help him, and we've just got a great relationship with him, and hope it continues for a long time.
Yeah, he's a good kid. You talked earlier about some of your clients, and you have two that I'd like to talk about. Alex Campbell, I met in California through Ron McAnally, and he's one of the classiest guys in our sport. You've had tremendous success for him. What's it like training for Mr. Campbell?
Well, it's going to be a bad talk. Unfortunately, he fired me a couple of years ago.
He did?
Yeah, I don't have anything for him, but that's the nature of our business. Mr. Campbell was one of the greatest. I mean, just a great job. I worked for him for, pretty much 20, 30 years, and had a lot of good horses for him. We won the Ashland, one of the last horses I had for him, with Carla Vivari, and It's Tea Time was a great stakes winner, and we went through a little bit of a bad run, and he decided to make a move, I guess, so a couple, 3 years ago. So I do not have anything, but I could not say anything but great things about him. I had a great run with him, and a lot of years, and class act. Good man.
Yeah, he must have given all the horses to Aiden O'Brien.
Graham Motion's close.
Well, that's close, yeah, that's close. That's funny. And then G. Watts Humphrey, his daughter Vicky is a trainer, and I've seen you guys out to dinner with her husband Phil, who I've known since he came to the United States probably 30 years ago. And I've always wanted to know how the Humphrey horses get split up. Is it like a fantasy draft, or are they assigned? How does all that work?
It's not even close. The Humphrey horses are handled by one person, and that'd be G. Watts Humphrey Jr. And he is the general manager, the owner, the coach, and he makes every decision on how they're split up, and that makes it so easy for Vicky and I to be very good friends, because we pull for each other. We do race against each other sometimes, but Watts, who I'll call him, Mr. Humphrey, I think I've worked for him 28 years, makes all those decisions. He's personally involved. He's a hands-on owner. I talk to him every day. And that's Christmas and New Year's and Thanksgiving, and we talk about his horses every day. Now, we'll add in other things after I've worked for him so long. We'll talk about football and basketball and UK and, San Luis Cardinals. But he talks to her every day about his horses, and he talks to me. That's his passion. That's his life, and that's what he does. So he makes all those big decisions.
Wow, that's cool. I had it figured out, like all the horses are there with their names on a board, and you pick one, Vicky picks one, and go back and forth. I had no idea that he just did it all himself. That's good.
All their names are on a board, and the only thing you're wrong about is how they get split on one side of the board to the other, and he is the man. He decides all that, and he has been so good to me. I think 28 years, I believe I've worked for him, and I think he probably it's somewhere split. I think early on I got all the good ones. Vicky had to fight her way through the lesser stock time. And through the years, as she's won graded races and developed her career, they're probably split more evenly. And It's just been a great operation to work for.
Yeah, that's really cool. It seems like you guys always have a good time when you're together, and you don't see a lot of that. There's so much rivalry and stuff in our business now that you don't see trainers hanging out like they used to. But I always admired that about you and Vicky and Phil. You guys have a good time when you're not working.
Yeah, it's there is that difference. You're right, though. When I started out, we hung out a lot. I mean, it was Shug and I did a lot together. The people, a big group of us, started around at the same time. I think Steve Penrod, Buzzy, who worked for Shug, was around there, and we all hung out. And through the years, it's become less and less. I mean, we've remained friends, but you don't see a lot of trainers with other trainers now. But we work for the same operation. We don't move horses back and forth, and I can't speak for them, but I don't think there is one bit of any type of jealousy in our operation. I know when I'm not running, I'm pulling for them, and I feel it's probably exactly the same way when we're running.
You mentioned Shug. I read your first big break came in 1985 when Shug took over the Phipps stable, and you became the trainer for Loblolly Stable, who owned Little Missouri. Is that true?
Well, my first big break, I think, was Wavering Monarch in 82. But in 85, when Shook took the Phipps job, I got several of the Loblolly horses. It wasn't taken over the stable. I think they were split two or three different ways. I think Eddie Gregson got some in California. Phil Hoswell got a group of them, and I got a group of them. And one of the ones I got was Little Missouri. And went on to win a Grade One. He won the Brooklyn and a few other races and went on to be a sire. So it was a great break for me to get Loblolly, and I worked for Johnny, and I think about 3 years. And when he left me, he took he took Tom as a private trainer. Actually, Tom Bohannon was my assistant at the time, had been with me 5 or 6 years, and he and Tom got along great. And Johnny had wanted to put everything kind of in one spot where he was the head guy, and I'd got fairly bigger at the time, and Tom went with him, and hell, the next 2 or 3 years, they won the Preakness with Pine Belter and I forgot the other horse's name right now, who was by Little Missouri, Prairie Bayou. He won 2 Preaknesses right when he went with Loblolly when he left me.
Well, Little Missouri, I don't know why I liked him so much, but I always liked him. And then he turned out to be a pretty good stallion, and Mr. Maybe, John Maybe, used to breed some mares to him, and I'd always bet on those horses. He was a pretty cool horse. Talk about him a minute.
He was a great, big, beautiful horse is what he was. And Cox's Ridge, which was Johnny, had a great run with Cox's Ridge. He was just gorgeous. He was big, he was strong, he was a little bit hard on himself because he hit the ground a little hard, he was so big, but he turned out to be a good horse, and he got an injury, I'm going to say probably a few months after he won the Brooklyn. He came back, and he did win another big race, I think it was the Stuyvesant, but it kept him from going to the next level, which I think he would have been a next level horse, but he was a fun horse to have.
Yeah, he was pretty cool. One of the horses that you trained that I was absolutely in love with was Center Court. You won the Jenny Wiley with her at Keeneland, but she was so consistent and just very attractive, I thought. What about her?
Yeah, she was special to us for 2 reasons, as I trained her mother for Watts, which was Lett, and she was one of the first crops of AP Indy, and she was a really, really good filly. She did not win a Grade One. She placed in some, I think, but I think it was a Grade Two she won. And this was one of her foals, and she came along and just was just magnificent. I mean, we really liked her. She would have liked to have kept her at that top level for another year. She had some issues and just didn't stay at that level. But when she was good for about a month or two running against Ken Ramsey's filly, we had a lot of fun running against her, and she was at a top level, and she was great to have.
Yeah, she was something else. I used to love watching her run. You won the Breeders' Futurity with Wicked Style. Now that's a 2-year-old race, obviously, something that you don't do a lot of. But as you mentioned, the fall is when your 2-year-olds start coming around.
Yeah, he had won Arlington Washington Futurity before that, and then he came back and won that. And I don't want to give all the credit to that, but he loved the Poly, dude. He just loved it. And I got fortunate that he came along when Keeneland had the Poly. He had broke his maiden on a Poly at Arlington. He won the Arlington Washington Futurity in just his second start, then came back here and won the Breeders' Futurity in his third start, and ran in that horrible day at Monmouth when so many horses, you know, ran on that bad track. And I think Steve Asmussen and I were talking one day how many horses ran that day that were never the same after that. It was just, you know, Nick Zito's horse won the juvenile, and I don't think he was the same again. It was just, you know, nobody's fault. It was just, but they have 3 days of monsoon rain, and they just ran on a really hard racetrack, and a lot of them, I don't think the horse was ever the same after that.
Yeah, there are some tracks. It happens every once in a while where they just seem to chew horses up on a particular day. I had a pretty nice horse named Ready to Order that beat Cavaneer twice, and he ran on a track at Santa Anita, and nobody came out of that race and did anything the rest of their life. I mean, it was just and you think about that and you go, how could it be so bad? It didn't really seem like that when we were running on it, but you just don't know.
It had just been rain and rain and rain. I think, you know, just they tried, because it was such a shame. It was such a nice place, Monmouth Park. I loved going there. And it just couldn't do anything about it. It just kept raining and raining. I think they were getting to the bottom of the racetrack. And if you went back and looked at the horses that ran that day that I don't think ever came back to the level they were at, there were quite a few of them. And I think Heat Wicked Style was one of them. I mean, he came back and won races. And he did well. I mean, he ran a great third to Blaine here in the Fayette, and a really good third. But he just never reached that level that he was, and I always thought it had to do with that.
You got me second-guessing myself here, but I have you with two spinster wins, Clear Mandate and Romantic Vision. Is that true?
That would be right. Quite a few years apart, too.
Yeah. Yeah, a long time between drinks. But that's a very special race, I think.
Yeah, when, you know, for the fall at Keeneland, that's probably the best filly in America. You know, it's to us, it's huge. Ashland in the spring and the spinster, if you're wanting to win a filly race at Keeneland, those are the two on the dirt. And it was special in a world. Clear Mandate was just such a good mare for the Humphrey family and for the farm. I mean, I think her first three foals brought $9 million. I'm very close on that. And she was a three-time Grade One winner at three different distances on three different tracks. She won a Grade One at Belmont, Saratoga, and Keeneland. And one was a mile, one was a mile and eighth, one was a mile and a quarter. And you don't get too many fillies to do that. So that was special to win with her. And Romantic Vision won it, last year. And she won her first Grade One as a five-year-old. And I was very proud of that, you know, that we kept her to a level and got her at her best as a five-year-old. And she was out of a longtime family. And same thing, back to the same Humphrey family.
Yeah, well, we talked about that, how your horses have careers, and a lot of them last a long time, and you really get to enjoy them. I mean, even me as a fan, watching your horses run, and you get to know them, you get to like them, you feel like you really have something special there, and it's really amazing. It's great that there are still trainers like you that really take your time and enjoy the horses and really try to find where they fit best and how to get them to the top level. And it's amazing.
It's a reflection of my owners and them allowing me to do that, because if you're not allowed to do that, it's not going to happen. And I'm just extremely fortunate of some of the people that I've been able to train horses for.
Is there any particular horse, not necessarily one that people know or is famous, but that you did one of your best training jobs on?
Well, I can almost just tell you right off the top of the bat that Corellian, I did the best training job ever did on a horse. And it was because he was never sound. He didn't have a sound day in his life. And I mean, Mr. Masson would take him home, and he'd send him back, and we'd win a couple races with him. He'd go home. And we brought him back with a 13-month layoff, and I guess it was either the Maker's Mark or it might have been named different at the time, and he got beat a nose by Court Vision on the last jump, and he hadn't raced in 13 months. And it was just the talent level of that horse was it's incredible how much talent he had. If he would have been one of those horses that had no issues, he would have really, really won some big races. But he, I think he had had a fractured sesamoid. He had a bow. He had a suspensory tear. And just, I remember saying in a forum one time after he ran, and they said, "What are you going to do with him next?" I said, "You go to the barn the next day and you walk him out and see if everything's still on him, if he's put together." Because he was just a neat horse. He's a beautiful horse. And I think his, Chris has his brother now, Chris Clement, who also is a very talented horse. What's his name? Frostborn. It's just some mare that they have. But that horse was probably one of the favorite horses that we had in the barn, and one of the most talented. And when you got him over there, he was hard to beat. You just had to get him there and get him there sound. And we did things with him. I think we trained him at Palm Meadows one winter, and I don't think he ever went to the dirt racetrack. They have a jogging trail there that's about a mile to the end and back, and I think we kept him on the jogging trail and spend 2-3 miles with him every day and work him on the turf course. So you had to get him there, and if you got him there, he gave it to you. He was just a really good horse.
Yeah, he won the Maker's Mark Mile, didn't he?
Yeah, he won it the year after he got beat a nose in it. He got beat one year, and I think he came back the next year and won it. But when you look at the year he got beat, he hadn't raced in 13 months, and I think they caught him on the last jump.
Yeah, that's brutal. Well,
and then he won it. He beat the same horse, I think, the next year. He beat Court Vision by a neck when he won it the next year.
Yeah, well, that's crazy. What, you know, when you have a horse like that that gives you everything, you just have to admire them, you know, because there's so many horses that they have great conformation, they're beautiful, they have a nice stride, and they don't really care whether they run or not, you know.
Exactly.
And then you get one like that, and it's like those are the kind of horses that make you want to go to the barn in the morning. I mean, sometimes you're afraid to look at them, but
no, you're right, especially after they run.
Yeah, right. That was great what you told those people, because you have that feeling sometimes. You just hope that everything's okay when you get there. But yeah. It's amazing. You won the Top Flight handicap when it was a grade one with Dreamy Mimi. What about her?
She was one of those tough Naskers, and she had fairly a long career. She ran in a lot of races and was just tough as nails and gave it to you every time. I don't think she was one of the more talented horses that I had, but she's one who tried hard, and she would get, you know, she got in the right spot on the right day to win a grade one. And I think there was, she was just tough and tried hard and would maybe outran herself a little bit. I don't think she had as much ability as a lot of other fillies I've had, but she went out there and gave it to you, and on one given day, she got a grade one in the books.
Yeah, that's cool. You mentioned earlier your wife, Sarah, just kind of in passing. Talk about her. I know she was a racetracker as well.
Yeah, she's still here every day. Big part of what we do. She's rides her pony up to the racetrack when she wants to now. That's the difference. And keeps an eye on the horses, and sits at a different part of the racetrack than I do. If I'm near the wire, she'll be at the 5/8 pole. If I'm at the 5/8 pole, she'll be at the wire, and she'll give me a lot of feedback on what she sees and knows a lot about them. I mean, she's been together a long time, and tell me what I did wrong every now and then with them, and that's part of working together. But we work together actually very, very well, and have for a long time. And she's crazy about the horses, and very, very involved in what we do.
Well, it's always great to have a wife or a husband that understands if you're a trainer, because a lot of times if you marry somebody that's not involved with the racetrack, they don't understand why you have to work on Saturday and Sunday, why you can't go to the kids' little league games, why you can't, you know, mow the lawn.
and we don't have kids, and that makes a big difference. So, you know, we travel together, and it makes it easier when we go to one spot to the next and go to Saratoga. That's probably why you see us out. We don't have those other things going on, and neither one of us had any, and it works well.
Yeah, well, that's great. That's fantastic. The best way to survive a racetrack marriage is to marry somebody off the racetrack.
Yeah, exactly.
You talked about going to UK, and I know you bleed blue. You go to as many basketball games as you can go to. Are you a super fan, or you just enjoy it?
No, I'm a nut. You know, I'm a UK basketball nut. Followed them forever since I was a kid. My favorite player of all time was Louis Dampier, and wore his jersey when I was a kid growing up, and been a fan that long. And you know, haven't just really taken to the one and dones. What the heck? Which they don't hate the game. It's just the way it's done now. I liked it when they were here for 4 years. I still have a great relationship with Dan Issel. I've had some horses for him, and you know, been a UK basketball fan hell since I was probably 5 or 6 years old, and still am. I don't like the fact that there's 5 players here and then you have 5 new ones next year, but that's just the way it's done now. So there's not a whole lot you can do about it. Can't blow your allegiance to the team over that.
Yeah, no. Well, we get a championship once in a while. I know it's hard to get used to, but it's the same with the horses, right? The money's so good now with everything that's so big that you can't really stay in school. You can't afford to.
No, it's just the way it is. And, you know, I'll make my statement on it. I'd rather have them for a year than play against them for a year. So I'm glad they're here. And it's a little harder to get used to. I mean, you used to, you know, watch them come around for the 4 years and be here. And it's just different. It's not bad or good. It's just different.
Yeah. Well, I know you like to golf. Is there anything else you like to do when you're off?
had to give the golf up. I used to like to play, but I haven't played in about 3 or 4 years. I had a lot of, you know, physical back issues, and I've had 4 back operations, so I gave golf up, and so that's probably why I'm interested in watching the basketball a little bit more now. But I hunt a little bit. And we, shoot sporting clays a little bit. And other than that, it's work.
Yeah. Well, I don't blame you there. That was an amazingly quick hour. I really thank you for taking the time to hang out with us this evening. And I really appreciate it.
Dude, anytime. And hope it went well. And hope you know, it's at any time y'all come. I'm just glad there's interest in what we do.
Oh, fantastic. It was great. Special thank you to our producer, Lee Della Pina, for keeping us in line and on time. And I want to remind everyone that the Preakness is this weekend. Join us Saturday for exclusive radio coverage of the Preakness live from Pimlico in Baltimore, Maryland. We start out with the Equine Forum at 8 Eastern. Saturday afternoon, we'll bring you coverage of the Preakness undercard beginning at 3. The Preakness broadcast at 5. For a complete list of affiliates, check our website, horseracingradio.net. You've been listening to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. This is Jude Feld from our Jimmy Johns of Lexington studios. Good night, everybody.